Noi selezioniamo le interviste e le riproponiamo per voi. Riascoltale su unicaradio.it o scaricale. Unica Radio, portala sempre con te.
Thank you very much. Let me also use the opportunity to thank the organizers of this wonderful conference, especially those whom I have had some chat with. They are here. I really appreciate for the invitation, and to be here, I'm absolutely delighted. I also am sorry that I cannot speak Italian, and actually hardly English, you will see. But this is what I have to offer, and we'll see. I also want to make a disclaimer, as Professor Combinini, that I'm not an expert on Gramsci, nor am I a scholar of Gramsci. I'm just a fan. So in the next 25 minutes, and please stop me, you know, when there's 5 minutes, just let me know. And I want to talk about the Arab revolutions from a comparative perspective, comparative with the revolutions of the 1970s. We can even say the 20th century, but in particular, the Iranian Revolution of 1979. And in this exposition, in this narrative, I want to just not to make a discussion, but perhaps make an observation that perhaps both Lenin and Gramsci find relevance, their perspective on revolution. I think both of them, in fact, find relevance, even if Gramsci and Lenin have had disagreements. Huh? And perhaps some disagreements will be revealed in my understanding of the Arab revolutions. As you know, at least symbolically, the Arab revolutions began with in Tunisia, with the self-immolation of the very poor subaltern street vendor in a very sort of depressed town of Sidi Bouzid, and protests galvanized in the streets of that city, and then other provincial cities, and moved gradually into north to Tunis. And in the course of perhaps less than 1 month, it brought down an entrenched dictator, Ben Ali. Then 10 days later, Egyptians did their revolution in the course of 18 days, they ousted another entrenched dictator, Hosni Mubarak. And then came Libya, and then Yemen, and then Syria, and Bahrain. And on the whole, 19 Arab states experienced mass revolts. 4 dictators were toppled, and the 5th were on the brink, and by which I mean Bashar al-Assad. Now, of course, I was following all this. I have lived through, and I'm, I think, old enough to say that I have lived through and witnessed 2 revolutionary episodes. So one was, the first was the revolutions of the late 1970s, in particular, Iranian Revolution, which I participated, and I reflected, and I wrote about it. And then, about 35 years later, I witnessed, as you did, these revolutions in the North Africa and in the Middle East. And about the Egypt in particular, I was living actually before the revolution for some 17 years in Egypt, and I had somewhat followed the developments there and had written about it. Now, so when I kind of, as I was following the Arab revolutions, I became increasingly perplexed by how different these revolutions were from the one that I had observed and I had participated in. To begin with, the Arab revolutions were happening in a region which the political scientists in particular had deemed, had viewed as unchangeable somewhat. So there was this notion of authoritarian durability that will really go on. But then when it happened, of course, it surprised everyone. Obviously, first the political scientists, and not to mention, of course, of the protagonists themselves. They were surprised by their own doing. Secondly, these revolutions were created by ordinary people, by really subaltern subject, with virtually no charismatic leaders, no unified organization, no specific ideology, no intellectual precursor, no Lenin or Trotsky, no Ayatollah Khomeini or Ali Shariati, no Václav Havel or Lech Wałęsa. All of these revolutions were unfolded by spectacular mobilization and mass revolts that kind of unfolded themselves in the urban squares, urban streets, in the places like in Tahrir or Taghir, that became, in a sense, a model of Maidan, which spread to many other countries in the world during the Occupy movements. And yet, and that's very important, and yet, these revolutions caused little change, little break from the old orders, especially little really change in the state institutions of the old regimes. So in a sense, these revolutions were rich as movement, but quite poor as change, because I see revolution both as movement and as change. So how to read and explain or interpret the Arab revolutions? I have a new book coming out called Revolution Without Revolutionaries. And I have tried to explain over there that these revolutions were quite peculiar, very different from the ones that we have experienced in the past. In fact, the trajectory of Arab Spring was different from at least two key pathways of political change, reform or revolution. They were not as such reform of political change in the sense of what happened in Mexico or Brazil, from authoritarianism into a democracy through pact and so on. They were not like that. Or the Iranian Green Movement that actually wanted to create such a thing, right, within Iran. And they were not a revolution in the sense that the protagonists sort of mobilized, organized in order to, in a sense, transform the state to begin with. So these were, I call them a revolution with F, kind of a mix of a revolution and a reform. In other words, these were the revolutionary movements that emerged to compel the existing states to reform themselves on behalf of the revolution. But the incumbent regimes or incumbent states who were supposed to reform themselves may or may not change themselves. And often they don't, because there are, of course, vested interests. So in fact, in Egypt or Tunisia or Yemen, many key institutions of the old regimes, like the security apparatus, like the media and financial powerful sort of business circles, cultural organization, all of these really basically remained unaltered. And the protagonists, it is those people who had actually initiated these spectacular, really, mobilizations, basically remained on the margin of the governmental power. They remained at the margin of the governmental power because they were not planning to be in the government. They were not planning to actually take the state power. But when, at some point, they realized that they should, then they didn't have really any means or the resources. They didn't have a powerful organization, powerful leadership, or hard power, or especially strategic vision as to do as what to do with it. So there was no dual power, no parallel governments, no revolutionary provisional governments, and so on. And by the way, let me say, I'm focusing here primarily on Egypt and Tunisia, and to some extent Yemen. The trajectory of Libya is very different, and Syria, especially because of the intervention excessive intervention of foreign actors. So these were different kinds of movements. And I think here is the relevance of Lenin, that actually had seen the necessity of really tackling and addressing the state power. What do you do with the state power, right? I think the Arab revolutions, in that respect, they were not unable to actually address that. But why were the Arab revolution different? Well, because I argue that the Arab uprisings occurred at a time where the very idea of revolution had been faded. In general, in fact, we didn't have revolutionaries anymore. Revolutionaries had ceased to exist. Let me explain this. I think up until the 1990s or so, three major ideologies or ideological traditions carried the idea of revolution as a strategy of fundamental change in societies. And they were anti-colonial nationalism, Marxist-Leninism, and in our region, militant Islamism. Of course, anti-colonial nationalists, people like Frantz Fanon, Ho Chi Minh, Nkrumah, many others actually, imagined post-colonial societies or a state as being fundamentally different from the ones that had been ruled basically by colonial states. One that could actually deject the political and economic domination of political powers and what they called then comprador bourgeoisie. But then, of course, this tradition came to an end because the nationalist revolutions had come to a halt after the decolonization process when it finished, and a formal colonization when it ended. But Marxist-Leninist ideology, as all of you know, the revolution was in the center of this ideology, and that included a number of movements that existed in the Middle East, like in the Yemeni revolution, of course, the earlier Yemeni revolution, in Oman or Dhofar, as well as in the Palestinian, of course, struggle, especially in the group PFLP. In Europe, despite the fact that Gramsci had been actually used or interpreted in a way to somewhat propose the idea of Eurocommunism and therefore not really think of seizure of power in the way that Lenin had done. Nevertheless, a number of Trotskyist organizations existed in which the idea of a revolution in the sense of fundamental change in the state institutions still was significant. So were in the many countries of the Global South and in the Middle East as well. But all of these changed dramatically after the Cold War, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, of course, and the Eastern Bloc. The anti-communist revolution in Eastern Europe and the end of Cold War ended the idea of revolution. The idea of revolution was so integral to socialism that the end of actually existing socialism meant the end of revolution as a deep change. And of course, with that also came the idea that state is bad. We're talking about big state and so on and so forth. Collectivity is bad, individual is good, and so on. I'll come back to it a bit later. So revolution became actually a dirty word, bad word. So identified with failed Marxism, strong state, and authoritarianism. But what actually helped, these dramatic change of discourse was the spread of course, neoliberalism. And neoliberalism, I mean here, is not just a series of package of state policies, but as a mode of governmentality, the way in which actually it structures, the way in which people, individual, behave and think. That basically there is no other alternative, and that's the end of history. So instead of the idea of socialism, state, and revolution, we saw an explosion in ideas of individual, of NGOs, of public sphere, of rational dialogue, nonviolence, market, and of course, reform. So reform became the name of the game and the strategy of the time pretty globally. For instance, in Iran, during the in the first decade of revolution, after the 1979, revolution was very much revered as a sacred concept, as something which is good, as something which has created that new regime. And by the time that Khatami was coming to power, but especially after when he came to power through election, revolution really became a dirty word. Inqilab, it was bad. Islah was good. Islahat, reform. Huh? And of course, we have now reform movement and reform government and reform everything, right? And there was a huge, actually, debate in the country, how revolution is bad, but reform is good. Now, the third tradition that carried the idea of revolution was, of course, militant Islamism. Marxist-Leninism and its idea of revolution had declined, but it had left its influence and its ideological rival in the Muslim world, and that means Islamism, militant Islamism. In fact, since the 1970s, the militant Islamist movements had drawn on the revolutionary ideas of Sayyid al-Qutb, an Egyptian Islamist. So they draw on his ideology to fight against the secular states in the Muslim world. Qutb himself had been influenced by the ideas of Indian Jamaat-Islami leader, Abul-Ala Maududi, who himself had been influenced by the Indian Communist Party, especially in terms of organization and so on. In fact, Qutb's book called Ma'alim Fit-Tariq, or Signpost, became, in a sense, the Islamist equivalent of Lenin's What is to be Done. So it is a big deal, really, for Islamists, how to do revolution. And Qutb's ideas furnished the ground for the vanguard of the Muslim militants to forcefully take over the jihad, jahili state, or corrupt state, or ungodly state, to establish the Islamic order. And this, in a sense, guided the strategy of the militant Islamist organization like Jihad, Al-Jama Islamiyah before the revolution, Lashkar-e-Jihad, Lashkar-e-Tayyubah, and many others in the Muslim societies. In fact, the Iranian revolution of 1979 had been informed both by Marxist idea of revolution as well as influences from Sayyid Qutb. In fact, the book that book by Sayyid Qutb had been translated by the current Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei from Arabic into Persian. but more important was, as Professor Panini mentioned, was the ideas of Ali Shariati, who had been himself, as you know, influenced by the French leftist George Gorvitch, who had who then, Shariati, I mean, advocated revolution in a mix of kind of Marxist and Islamic idiom, like class struggle, but especially his idea of divine classless society. And he became very, very powerful. And I was, at the time, I was myself leftist, kind of jealous by his ideas and so on, because he was talking from Islamic idiom, but he seemed to know this side and that side. But he was very influential. So revolution, therefore, had been central to the politics of militant Islamism. But this also began to change, I think, with the crisis of Islamism. By crisis, I mean the fact that, Iranian revolution, you had the war, and it didn't really work very well. And then there was a lot of dissatisfaction in Iran through a lot of social movements that wanted really to change the meaning of the Islamic polity in Iran. Or it had instigated exclusion, it had instigated violence, and so on. So Islamism was in crisis, and this crisis, I think, opened up the possibility of what I have called a move towards post-Islamist conception of Islamic rule. Post-Islamists are, by definition, post-revolutionaries, that is, post-idea of revolution, that is. Because post-Islamism is a critical departure from the Islamist discourse on violence, militancy, and revolutionary rhetoric. Post-Islamists pursue not revolutions, they pursue nonviolent, gradualist, and reform path towards their Islamic project. Basically, their Islamic project is not necessarily having an Islamic state, but they like to have a pious society, right? Non-religious state, but a religious and pious society. And these include the reform of government in Iran, like Mohammad Khatami. To me, he's a post-Islamist. Or AKP, at least for some time. PJD in Maghreb.
Morocco.
And of course, Tunisia's Ennahda. So while Islamism and its revolutionism had really a foot in the kind of discourse of Cold War, the current sort of post-Islamism is partly linked and informed by the political language of the Cold War period, the language of, again, civil society, accountability, nonviolence, reform, and of course, the language of market. So the Arab uprising really occurred against this background, against the backdrop of the end of prevailing post-colonial ideologies. So there's Arab nationalism, Marxism, and Islamism, in which the idea of revolution was really prominent. So with the decline of these ideologies, the idea of revolution also came to a halt. Consequently, the Arab protagonists, that is those people who actually initiated the uprising so impressively, were not really tuned to the idea of revolution. They had not thought, they had not strategized and prepared themselves for its unfolding. You know, in the late 1970s, when I was a student myself and so on, kind of leftist, we used to go around in Tehran in the posh areas, and I remember we used to say, well, I think we'll take over this palace and give them to the poor and so forth. Yeah? All especially Shah's palace, we'll storm in it and so forth. So in other words, we're thinking in those in terms of revolution, in that sense. But in the Middle East of the time that I was in Egypt, really almost no political groupings and so on thinking in these terms. The Arab political reformers remained basically that. They were reformist. If you look at whether it is in Yemen, that key thing actually was Al-Qaeda, which we can talk about it, is not particularly revolutionary in the sense that I understand it. In Tunisia, in fact, political class had been sort of experience of political death as they were telling me. In Egypt, Kefaya movement or April 6th movement and so on, basically they were not revolutionary in the sense that I understand it. Yeah, some of the protagonists, some of the activists had been gotten training from, in the United States, in Qatar, in Serbia. But trainings basically were largely in the areas of election monitoring, tactics of nonviolence, protests, or building basically networks. They were not revolutionary as such. Consequently, what their activism inspired when the revolts sort of took place were not a revolution. Maybe I haven't said what I mean by it. By revolution, I mean rapid and radical transformation of the state minimally pushed by popular movement from below, which then opens up the possibility of then societal change. Yeah? So they were not thinking in these terms. So what was transpired were not revolutions, but revolutions with F, that is, revolutionary movements that are put in a position to compel the incumbent states to reform themselves. So, but revolutions do have some advantages. They are good in some way. Well, first of all, they are perhaps less disruptive, there are less destructions really happen in them. And I think that's very important, especially economically. So the people basically after any big revolutionary uprising want to go back to normality and they want their wages paid and go back to work and so forth. But usually revolutions are very disruptive. So in this sense, it is good and less destructive. And also it is more civil and less violent and more, especially more pluralistic than, shall we say, the revolutions of 1970s. For instance, in the revolution of 1970s, like Iranian revolution, revolutionaries, when they take on power, banking on their political capital, can actually easily wipe out the new opposition against them and create a monopolistic power centers. But the Arab revolutions or revolutions, that model, it is very difficult for those people who are in the government to monopolize power, because revolutions are by default pluralistic, because and not only you have an insurgent sort of civil society that has emerged, but also you have also the organizations of the old regime people who are still around, because you haven't actually controlled them yet. But precisely because the people and the institutions of the old order continue to operate, you have always the danger of counter-revolution. That because it has not been transformed, so the people who are there, they nest in there, they start actually to organize it, to reverse things. So there is therefore always, or the stronger, in a sense, a danger of counter-revolutions. So the challenge is how to maintain pluralism and yet make the new democratic rule resistance to counter-revolutionary restoration. I think Tunisia and Egypt represent two interesting cases. In Tunisia, the broad coalition that managed by I think three significant forces, and that was the inclusive Ennahda, labor movement, and the secular forces, they came to a consensus to work together and create a very significant, I think, democratic constitution. And I think a good part of it, credit should here go to a very organized labor movement, and also the inclusivity of Ennahda. It's post-Islamism that actually allowed it to work with other groupings, including the secular groupings. Whereas in Egypt, when Muslim Brothers were in power, they were more exclusivist. And they were actually trying to work for their own tribe, rather than actually work for the entire nation, for Egypt. Hence, the position became weak, and the army, which was already there, had not been transformed, the counter-revolutionaries, nicely used the opportunity to overturn and get rid of them. yet, and that's the last point, in their totality, a revolution are more than the transformation of the state. Even if the transformation of the state is extremely significant, but the revolutions are more than that. Revolutions have also a social side. The level of the grassroots, the level of the subaltern, the level of the everyday. The level of the change in attitudes and expectations and the social roles and the radical practices that emerge and galvanize even within those 1 month or 18 days. So therefore the story of revolution would be really incomplete without narrating what happens in the underside, on the margin. I think these, in fact, the kind of changes that take place on the underside and often actually remain invisible is extremely important, because they can be the precursor for revival of revolutionary movements and even stealthy transformation in post-revolutionary times. And it is here, I think, that Gramsci becomes relevant, through actually working through the societal and revive the revolutionary spirit, not only spirit, but also initiatives for the transformation and move forward, so that you actually create what I understand from Gramsci, revolution before revolution. Thank you very much.
Selezioniamo le interviste realizzate e le riproponiamo per voi. Musicisti, innovatori, artisti, sportivi, operatori sociali. Raccontiamo la città che cambia. Un archivio unico a disposizione. Scelti da noi e messi in onda per voi. Unica Radio, B-Podcast.